Chapter 10. A Blazing Beacon. The wide-eyed maid was more used to kneading bread dough than doing up rows of tiny buttons, but eventually she finished buttoning Elaine into her dark green riding dress, curtsied, and stepped back, breathing heavily, though whether from the effort of concentration or just from being in the presence of the daughter heir was hard to tell. The great serpent ring on Elaine's left hand might have had something to do with it, too. Just over 20 miles in a straight line would take you from the manor of House Matherin to the river Arannon and all its great commerce. But the distance was far greater in actual miles to be covered through the Chishan Mountains, and people here were more accustomed to cattle raids across the border from Murundi than any sort of visitor, especially a visitor who wrapped the daughter heir and an Aes Sedai into one package. The honor seemed beyond what some of the servants could bear. Elsie had been painfully conscientious in folding the blue silk gown that Elaine had worn last night and packing it away in a large leather traveling chest, one of a pair in the apartment's dressing room, so conscientious that Elaine had nearly taken over the task herself. She had slept poorly at first, fitful and waking, then slept late when she could sleep, and she was beyond chafing to be on her way back to Camelin. This was the fifth time she had spent a night out of Camelin since learning the city was threatened, and on each trip she had given a day to visiting 3 or 4 manors, once 5, all the property of men and women bound to House Trachand by blood or oaths, and every visit took time. The press of time weighed down her bones, yet presenting the proper image was necessary. Riding clothes were needed to travel from one manor to the next, lest she arrived rumpled and looking a fugitive, but she had to change before settling in, whether it was for the night or just a few hours. Half those hours might be taken up by shifting from riding clothes to a gown and back again, but riding clothes spoke of haste and need, perhaps of desperation, while the coronet of the daughter heir and an embroidered gown trimmed with lace, unpacked from a set of traveling cases and donned after washing, portrayed confidence and strength. She would have brought her own maid to add to the impression if Asanda had been up to keeping the pace in winter, though she suspected the white-haired woman's slowness would have had her chewing her tongue in frustration. Still, Asanda could not have been as slow as this goggle-eyed young Elsie. At last Elsie handed her fur-lined crimson cloak with a curtsy, and she slung the cloak around her shoulders hastily. A fire blazed on the stone hearth, but the room was nowhere near warm, and recently she could not seem to ignore the cold with any reliability. The girl bobbed as she asked whether she could fetch men to carry down the chests if it pleased Her Majesty. The first time she had done that, Elaine had gently explained that she was not yet queen, but Elsie seemed horrified at the idea of addressing her simply as my lady or even as princess, though, in truth, the last was considered very old-fashioned. Proper or not, it usually pleased Elaine to hear someone acknowledge her right to the throne, but this morning she was too tired to be anything but anxious to be on the road. Suppressing a yawn, she told Elsie curtly to fetch the men and be quick about it, and turned for the panelled door. The girl rushed to open it for her, which took longer than if she had done it herself, with a curtsy before opening and yet another after. Her divided silk skirts whispered furiously against each other as she strode out of the room, tugging on her red riding gloves. If Elsie had delayed her one more second, she thought she would have screamed. It was the girl who shrieked, however, before Elaine had gone 3 paces, a horrified howl that sounded ripped from her throat. The cloak flared as Elaine spun around, embracing the true source, feeling the richness of Sidar flood through her. Elsie was standing on the strip of carpet that ran along the middle of the pale brown floor tiles, staring the other way down the hall with both hands pressed to her mouth. 2 crossing corridors opened in that direction, but there was not another soul in sight. "What is it, Elsie?" Elaine demanded. She had several weaves already on the edge of forming, ranging from a simple net of air to a fireball that would have demolished half the walls in front of her, and in her present humor she wanted to use one of them, to strike out with the power. Her moods were uncertain of late, to say the least. The girl looked back over one shoulder, trembling, and if her eyes had been wide before, they bulged now. Her hands remained clamped to her mouth as if to prevent another scream. Dark-haired and dark-eyed, tall and plump-bosomed in House Matherin's gray and blue livery, she was not really a girl. Elsie might be 4 or 5 years older than herself, but the way she behaved made it difficult to think of her any other way. "What is it, Elsie? And don't tell me it was nothing. You look as if you'd seen a ghost." The girl flinched. "I did," she said unsteadily. That she gave Elaine no title showed just how unsteady she was. "Lady Nalaine, as was Lord Eadman's grandmother. She died when I was little, but I remember even Lord Eadman tiptoed around her temper, and the maids used to jump if she looked at them, and other ladies who visited too, and the lords as well. Everybody was afraid of her. She was right there in front of me, and she scowled so furious." She broke off, blushing, when Elaine laughed. It was more a laugh of relief than anything else. The Black Adja had not somehow followed her to Lord Eadman's manor. There were no assassins waiting with knives in their fists, no sisters loyal to Elida wanting to whisk her back to Tar Valon. Sometimes she dreamed about those things, about all of them in the same dream. She released Sidar, reluctantly as always, regretful as that fullness of joy and life drained out of her. Matherin supported her, but Eadman might have taken it amiss if she had ruined half his home place. "The dead cannot harm the living, Elsie," she said gently, the more gently because she had laughed, not to mention wanting to box the ninny's ears. "They're not of this world any more, and they can't touch anything in it, including us." The girl nodded and dropped another curtsy, but by the size of her eyes and the trembling of her lips, she was unconvinced. Elaine had no time to cosset her, though. "Fetch the men for my cases, Elsie," she said firmly, "and don't worry about ghosts." With yet another curtsy, the girl dashed off, her head swiveling anxiously in case the Lady Nalaine leaped out of the paneled walls. Ghosts! The fool girl was a ninny. Matherin was an old house, if not large or strong, and the main stairs leading down to the entry hall were broad and trimmed with marble railings. The entry hall itself was a generous space, with gray and blue floor tiles and mirrored oil lamps hanging on chains from the ceiling 20 feet above. There was nothing in the way of gilding and little inlay, but ornately carved chests and cabinets stood along the sides of the hall, and 2 wall hangings were displayed on 1 wall. One showed men hunting leopards from horseback, a chancy business at best, and the other women of House Matherin presenting a sword to the first Queen of Andor, an event that Matherin treasured, and that might or might not have actually happened. Avienda was already down, pacing restlessly in the hall, and Elaine sighed at the sight. They would have shared a room, if not for the implication that Matherin could not provide adequately for 2 visitors of note, but Avienda did not really understand that the smaller the house, the loftier the pride. Often the smaller houses possessed little more. Pride, she should have understood, since a fierce pride and strength all but shone from her. Straight-backed and even taller than Elaine, a thick dark shawl draped over her pale blouse, and a folded gray headscarf holding back her long reddish hair, she was the very picture of a wise one, despite being only a year older than Elaine. Wise ones who could channel often appeared to be much younger than they were, and Avienda had the dignity. At this moment she did anyway, though the pair of them had giggled together often enough. Of course, her only jewelry was a long silver Kandori necklace, an amber brooch in the shape of a turtle, and a wide ivory bracelet. And wise ones always wore festoons of necklaces and bracelets. But Avienda was not a wise one yet, merely an apprentice. Elaine never thought of Avienda as merely anything, but it did present problems now and then. Sometimes she thought the wise ones considered her an apprentice of some sort as well, or at least a student. A silly thought, to be sure, but sometimes... As Elaine reached the foot of the stairs, Avienda adjusted her shawl and asked, "Did you sleep well?" Her tone was untroubled, but anxiety nestled around her green eyes. "You did not send for wine to help you sleep, did you? I made sure your wine was watered when we ate, but I saw you looking at the wine pitcher."
"Yes, mother," Elaine said in a sickly sweet voice. "No, mother. I was wondering how Eadman got his hands on such a fine vintage, mother. It was a shame to water it, and I drank the goat's milk before I went to sleep."
If anything brought her to birthing sickness, it would be goat's milk. And to think she used to like it. Avienda planted her fists on her hips, such an embodiment of indignation that Elaine had to laugh. There were inconveniences to being with child, ranging from abrupt swings in her temper to tenderness in her breasts to always being tired, but the coddling was the worst in some ways. Everyone in the royal palace knew she was pregnant. A good many had known before she did, courtesy of Min's viewing and Min being too free with her tongue, and she did not think she could have been so mothered when she was an infant. Still, she put up with all the bother with as much grace as she could muster. Usually she did. They were only trying to be helpful. She just wished every woman she knew did not believe that pregnancy had made her brainless. Nearly every woman she knew. Those who had never borne a child themselves were the worst. Thinking of her baby, at times she wished Min had said whether it would be a boy or girl, or rather that Avienda or Birgitta could recall exactly what Min actually had said. Min was always right, but the three of them had consumed a great deal of wine that night, and Min had been gone from the palace long before Elaine herself knew to ask. Thinking of the child growing in her always made her think of Rand, just as thinking of him made her think of the babe. One followed the other as surely as cream rose in the milk pan. She missed Rand terribly, and yet she could not miss him. A part of him, the sense of him, rode always in the back of her head, unless she masked the bond right alongside her sense of Birgitta, her other warder. The bond had its limits, however. He was somewhere to the west, far enough that she could tell little more than that he was alive. Nothing more, really, though she thought she would know if he had been badly injured. She was not sure she wanted to know what he was up to. He had been far to the south for a long time after leaving her, and now, just this morning, he had travelled to the west. It was disconcerting, really, to feel him in one direction and then suddenly have him off in another, even farther away. He could be pursuing enemies or running from enemies or any one of a thousand things. She hoped very much it was something innocuous that made him travel. He was going to die on her all too soon. Men who could channel always died of it, but she wanted so very much to keep him alive as long as possible. "He is well," Avienda said, almost as though she could read her mind. They had their own shared sense of one another since their mutual adoption as first sisters, but it did not go as far as the warder bond they and Min shared with Rand. "If he allows himself to be killed, I will cut off his ears." Elaine blinked, then laughed again, and after a startled glance, Avienda joined in. It was not that funny, except maybe to an Aiel. Avienda's sense of humor was very odd. But Elaine could not stop laughing, and Avienda seemed as helpless. Shaking with mirth, they hugged one another and hung on. Life was very strange. Had anyone told her a few years ago that she would share a man with another woman, with two other women, she would have called them mad. The very idea would have been indecent. But she loved Avienda every bit as much as she did Rand, only in a different way, and Avienda loved Rand as much as she did. Denying that meant denying Avienda, and she could as easily step out of her skin. Aiel women, sisters or close friends, often married the same man and seldom gave him any say in the matter. She was going to marry Rand, and so was Avienda, and so was Min. Whatever anyone said or thought, that was all there was to it. If he lived long enough.
Suddenly she became afraid that her laughter was edging toward tears. Please, Light, let her not be one of those women who became weepy when they were with child. It was bad enough not knowing whether she was going to be melancholy or furious from one minute to the next. Hours might pass when she felt perfectly normal, but then there were hours when she felt like a child's ball bouncing down an endless flight of stairs. This morning she seemed to be on the stairs. "He is well, and he will be well," Avienda whispered fiercely, as if she intended to assure his survival by killing anything that threatened him. With the tips of her fingers, Elaine brushed a tear from her sister's cheek. "He is well, and he will be well," she agreed softly. But they could not kill Saidin, and the taint on the male half of the power was what was going to kill him. The lamps overhead flickered as one of the tall doors to the outside opened, letting in a gust of air even colder than that in the entry hall, and they quickly moved a little apart, just holding hands. Elaine schooled her face to a serene smoothness fully worthy of an Aes Sedai. She could not afford to let anyone see her apparently seeking comfort in a hug. A ruler, or one who sought to rule, was not allowed the slightest suggestion of weakness or tears. Not in public. There were rumors enough about her as it was, as many bad as good. She was benevolent or cruel, fair-minded or arbitrary, generous or avaricious, all according to which tale you listened to. At least the tales balanced out one another, but anyone who could say they had actually seen the daughter heir huddling in the arms of her companion might add a tale of fear to the blend. And if her enemies believed she was afraid, they would only grow bolder and stronger. Cowardice was the sort of rumor that stuck like greasy mud. You could never wash it off completely. History recorded women who had lost their bids for the Lion Throne on no further discernible grounds. Capability was a requirement for a successful ruler, and wisdom was to be hoped for, though women lacking both had gained the throne and muddled through somehow, but few would support a coward, and none of those people she wanted on her side. The man who came in, turning to push the massive door shut behind him, had only one leg and used a crutch in place of the other. Even with fleece padding, the sleeve of his heavy woolen coat was worn from it. A heavy-shouldered former soldier, Fridwin Ross, managed Lord Eadman's estate with the aid of a fat clerk who had blinked at the daughter heir in consternation, gaped at her great serpent ring with something near to awe, and scurried back to his ledgers in relief as soon as he realized she had no business with him. He had probably feared a levy on the manor's accounts. Master Ross had stared at her ring in amazement, to be sure, but he had grinned with delight at the daughter heir and regretted that he could no longer ride for her with such sincerity that, had he been a liar, he would already have bilked Eadman and the clerk of everything they owned between them. She did not fear him carrying the wrong tales. His crutch made a rhythmic thump as he came up the hall, and he managed a credible bow in spite of it, including Avienda in his courtesy. He had been startled by her at first, but surprisingly quick to catch their friendship, and if he did not entirely trust an Aiel, it meant he accepted her. You could not ask for everything.
"The men are strapping your cases to the pack animals, my queen, and your escort is ready."
He was one of those who refused to call her anything except my queen or majesty, but a hint of doubt entered his voice at mention of her escort. He covered it hastily with a cough and hurried on.
"The men we're sending with you are all mounted as well as I could manage. Young men, mainly, and a few more experienced, but they all know which end of a halberd has the point. I wish the manor could give you more, but I explained when Lord Eadman heard there were others claiming what's yours by right, he decided not to wait for spring, and he called in his armsmen and set out for Camelin. We've had a couple of bad snowfalls since, but he might be halfway there by now, with luck in the passes."
His gaze carried conviction, but he knew better than she that with the wrong luck, Eadman and his armsmen might be dead in those passes.
"Matherin has always maintained faith with Trakand," Elaine told him, "and I put my trust that it always will. I value Lord Eadman's loyalty, Master Ross, and yours."
She did not insult Matherin and him by promising to remember or offering rewards, yet Master Ross's broad smile said she had already given him as much reward as he desired. Matherin would receive rewards if they were earned, but they could not be held out as if offering to buy a horse. Thumping along on his crutch, Master Ross bowed her to the door and bowed her out onto the broad granite step, where servants wearing heavy coats waited in the bitter cold with a stirrup cup of hot spiced wine that she rejected with a murmur. Until she had a chance to adjust to the sharp air, she wanted both hands to hold her cloak closed. Avienda would probably have found a way to make her drop it anyway. She took a cup, after wrapping her shawl around her head and shoulders, the only concession she made to the icy morning. She was ignoring the cold, of course. Elaine was the one who had taught her how. Elaine tried again to push the cold away, and to her surprise, it receded. Not all the way. She still felt chilly, but it was better than freezing. The sky was clear, the sun bright as it sat over the mountains, but storm clouds could come boiling across the surrounding peaks at any time. It would be best to reach their first destination today as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, Fireheart, her tall black gelding, was living up to his name, rearing and snorting gouts of steamy breath as if he had never worn a bridle before, and Avienda's leggy, arch-necked grey had taken it into her head to imitate him, dancing in the knee-deep snow and trying to go anywhere except where the groom tried to lead her. She was a more spirited animal than Elaine would have chosen for her sister, yet Avienda herself had insisted after learning the mare's name. Siswai meant spear in the old tongue. The grooms seemed capable women, but they appeared to think they needed to calm the animals before handing them over. It was all Elaine could do not to snap at them that she had managed Fireheart before they ever saw him. Her escort was already mounted, to avoid standing in the snow. 20-odd riders in the white-collared red coats and brightly burnished breastplates and helmets of the Queen's Guard. Master Ross's doubt might be explained by the fact that the riders' coats were silk, as were their red breeches with the white stripe up each leg, and by the pale lace they wore at neck and cuff. They certainly appeared more ceremonial than effective. Or it might have been that they were all women. Women were uncommon in jobs that required using weapons, just the occasional merchant's guard or a rare woman who turned up in an army during time of war. And Elaine had never heard of a group of all-female soldiers before she created one. Except the maidens, of course. But they were Aiel, and a different matter. She hoped people would think them an affectation on her part, and largely decorative with all the lace and silk. Men tended to underestimate a woman carrying weapons until they faced one, and even most other women tended to think her a brainless fool. Bodyguards usually tried to appear so ferocious that no one would dare trying to get past them, but her enemies would just find a new way to attack if she stood the whole Queen's Guard around her, shoulder to shoulder. A bodyguard her enemies would dismiss until it was too late for more than regrets was her aim. She intended to make their uniforms more elaborate, partly to feed those misconceptions, and partly to feed the women's pride as soldiers marked out from the rest, but she herself had no doubts. Every one of them, from merchants' guards to hunters of the horn, had been carefully chosen for her skills, experience, and courage. She was ready to put her life in their hands. She already had. A lean woman wearing a lieutenant's 2 golden knots on the shoulder of her red cloak saluted Elaine with an arm across her chest, and her roan gelding tossed his head, making the silver bells in his mane chime faintly, as if he too were saluting.
"We are ready, my lady, and the area is clear."
Kasela Razkofni was one of those who had been a merchant's guard, and her Arafelan accents were not those of an educated woman, but her voice was brisk and no-nonsense. She used the proper form of address and would until Elaine was crowned, yet she was ready to fight to gain that crown for Elaine. Very, very few, male or female, signed the roster of the Queen's Guard these days unless they were ready for that.
The men Master Ross handed over are ready, too. As ready as they'll ever be.
Clearing his throat, the man shifted his crutch and took to studying the snow in front of his boots. Elaine could see what Casela meant. Master Ross had scraped together 11 men from the manor to send to Camelin and outfitted them with halberds and short swords and what armor he could find, 9 antique helmets without face guards, and 7 breastplates with dents that made them vulnerable. Their mounts were not bad, though hairy with their winter coats. But even huddled as their riders were in thick cloaks, she could see that 8 were unlikely to need to shave above once in a week, if that. The men Master Ross had described as being experienced had wrinkled faces and bony hands, and probably not a full set of teeth between them. He had not been lying or trying to stint. Eadman would have gathered all the fit men in the area to take with him and outfitted them in the best he had. The story had been the same everywhere. Apparently a great number of hale and hearty men scattered the length of Andor were trying to reach her in Camelin, and none of them likely to get into the city until all was decided now. She could search every day without finding a single band. Still, this little bunch held their halberds as if they knew how to use them. Then again, that was not hard to do, sitting a saddle at rest with the halberd's butt tucked in your stirrup. She could have managed that.
"We have visited 19 of these manors, sister," Avienda said softly, moving closer until their shoulders touched. "And counting these, we have gathered 205 boys too young to be blooded, and old men who should have laid down the spear long ago. I have not asked before. You know your people and your ways. Is this worth the time you give it?"
"Oh, yes, sister."
Elaine kept her voice just as low, so the one-legged former soldier and the servants could not overhear. The best of people could turn mule-headed if they realized you wanted them to behave a certain way, particularly if they realized that the help they had painfully gathered and offered and you had accepted was not what you were after at all.
"Everyone in that village down by the river knows I'm here by now, and so do half the farms for miles. By noon the other half will know, and by tomorrow the next village over and more farms. News travels slowly in winter, especially in this country. They know I've spoken my claim to the throne, yet if I gain the throne tomorrow or die tomorrow, they might not learn of it before the middle of spring, maybe not even until summer. But today they know that Elaine Trakand is alive, that she visited the manor in silks and jewels and summoned men to her banner. People 20 miles from here will claim they saw me and touched my hand. Few people can say that without speaking in favor of whoever they claim to have seen. And when you speak in favor of someone, you convince yourself to favor them. There are men and women in 19 places around Andor talking about how they saw the daughter heir just this last week, and every day the area that talk covers spreads like an ink blot. If I had time, I'd visit every village in Andor. It won't make a hair of difference in what happens in Camelin, but it may make all the difference after I win." She would not admit to any possibility other than winning, especially not given who would take the throne if she failed. "Most queens in our history spent the first years of their rule gathering the people solidly behind them, Avienda, and some never did. But harder times than these are coming. I may not have 1 year before I need every Andoran to stand behind me. I can't wait until I have the throne. Harder times are coming, and I have to be ready. Andor has to be ready, and I must make it so," she finished firmly. Smiling, Avienda touched Elaine's cheek. "I think I will learn a great deal about being a wise one from you." To her mortification, Elaine blushed in embarrassment. Her cheeks felt on fire. Maybe the swings in humor were worse than the cosseting. Light! She had months of this to look forward to. Not for the first time, she found a kernel of resentment toward Rand. He had done this to her. All right. She had helped him. Instigated the doing, in fact, but that was beside the point. He had done this and walked away with a smug grin on his face.
She doubted his grin had really been smug, but she could picture it all too easily. Let him dart from giddy to weepy every other hour and see how he liked it. I can't think in a straight line, she thought irritably. That was his fault, too. The grooms finally deemed Fireheart and Avienda's siswai meek enough to be mounted by ladies, and Avienda climbed to her saddle from the stone mounting block with a good deal more grace than she once had shown, arranging her bulky, undivided skirts to cover as much of her dark-stockinged legs as possible. She still believed that her own legs were superior to any horse, yet she had become a passable rider, though she did have a tendency to look surprised when the horse did as she wanted. Fireheart tried to dance once Elaine was on his back, but she reined him in smartly, and a bit more sharply than she would have normally. Her teetering moods had taken her to a sudden sense of dread for Rand, and if she could not ensure his safety, there was one male at hand she could make certain did exactly as he was supposed to. Six of the guardswomen led the way down the road from the manor at a slow walk, all the depth of snow would allow, with the rest following her and Avienda in smart columns, the last horsewomen in line leading the pack animals. The local men trailed behind raggedly with their own pack horse, a shaggy creature tied about with cook pots and rough bundles, and even half a dozen live chickens. A few cheers greeted them as they rode through the thatch-roofed village and across the stone bridge that crossed a snake-curved frozen stream. Loud cries of "Elaine of the Lily!" and "Trakand! Trakand!" and "Matherin stands!" But she saw a woman crying on her husband's chest, and tears on his face too, and another woman who stood with her back to the riders and her head down, refusing even to look. Elaine hoped she would send their sons home to them. There should be little fighting at Camelin unless she blundered badly, but there would be some. And once the Rose Crown was hers, battles lay ahead. To the south lay the Shan Chan, and to the north Myrdral and Trollocs waiting to descend for Tarman Gaiden. Andor would bleed sons in the days to come. Burn her, she was not going to cry. Beyond the bridge the road slanted up again, a steep climb through pine and fir and leather leaf, but it was no more than a long mile to the mountain meadow they sought. The snow shining beneath the mid-morning sun still bore the marks of hooves, coming from where a gateway had left a deep furrow in the snow. It could have been nearer the manor, but the possibility of someone standing where your gateway opened was always the danger. The glow of Saidar surrounded Avienda as they rode into the meadow. She had made the gateway to come here from their last stop yesterday afternoon, the manor 100 miles north, so she would weave the gateway to go to Camelin. But the sight of Avienda shining with the power made Elaine go broody. Whoever made the gateway to leave Camelin always ended up making all the others until they returned, since she learned the ground at each place her gateway touched. But on each of their 5 trips, Avienda had asked to make that first gateway. She might simply have wanted the practice, as she claimed, though Elaine hardly had more practice than she did. But another possibility had come to mind. Maybe Avienda wanted to keep her from channeling, in any considerable amount at least, because she was pregnant. The weave that had made them sisters of the same mother could not have been used if either of them had been with child, because the unborn child would have shared in the bond, a thing it could not be strong enough to survive. But surely one of the Aes Sedai in the palace would have said something if channeling was to be avoided in pregnancy. Then again, very few Aes Sedai ever bore children. They might not know. She was aware there were many things Aes Sedai did not know, however much they might pretend otherwise to the rest of the world. She herself had taken advantage of that presumption from time to time, but it seemed very strange that they might be ignorant of something so important to most women. It was as though a bird knew how to eat every seed and grain except barley, so supposedly knew, because if it did not know how to eat barley, what else might it be ignorant of? Wise ones bore children, though, and they had said nothing about... Abruptly, concerns over her babe and channeling and what Aes Sedai might or might not know were pushed right out of her head. She could feel someone channeling Sayidar. Not Avienda, not someone on one of the surrounding mountains, not anyone near as close as that. This was distant, like a beacon blazing on a far mountain top in the night. A very distant mountain. She could not imagine how much of the One Power was needed for her to feel channeling at that distance. Every woman in the world who could channel must be able to sense this, to point straight to it. And the beacon lay to the west. Nothing had changed in the bond with Rand. She could not have said exactly where he was within 100 miles, but she knew. "He's in danger," she said. "We must go to him, Avienda." Avienda gave herself a shake and stopped staring westward. The glow remained around her, and Elaine could feel that she had drawn on the source as deeply as she could. But even as Avienda turned to her, she felt the amount of Sayidar the other woman held dwindle. "We must not, Elaine." Aghast, Elaine twisted in Fireheart's saddle to stare at her. "You want to abandon him? To that?" No one could handle so much of Sayidar, not the strongest circle, not unaided. Supposedly a Sa'angreal existed, greater than anything else ever made, and if what she had heard was correct, that might be able to handle this, maybe. But from what she had heard, no woman could use it and live, not without Turangreal made for the purpose, and no one had ever seen one that she knew of. Surely no sister would try, even if she had found one. That much of the One Power could level mountain ranges at a stroke. No sister would try, except perhaps one of the Black Aja, or worse, one of the Forsaken, maybe more than one. What else could it be? And Avienda simply wanted to ignore it, when she must know that Rand was there? The guardswomen, unaware, were still waiting patiently on their horses, keeping watch on the tree line around the meadow and little concerned with that after their reception at the manor, though Casela was watching Elaine and Avienda, a slight frown visible behind the face bars of her helmet. She knew they never delayed at opening a gateway. The men from the manor were gathering around their pack horses, pawing at the bundles and apparently arguing over whether or not something had been included. Avienda still moved her gray closer to Elaine's black and spoke in a voice that would not carry. "We know nothing, Elaine. Not whether he is dancing the spears or this is something else. If he dances the spears and we rush in, will he attack us before he knows who we are? Will we distract him because he does not expect us and allow his enemies to win? If he dies, we will find who took his life and kill them, but if we go to him now, we go blindly, and we may bring disaster on our backs."
"We could be careful," Elaine said sullenly. It infuriated her that she was feeling sullen and showing it, but all she could do was ride her moods and try not to let them get the upper hand completely. "We don't have to travel right to the spot." Gripping her pouch, feeling the small ivory carving of a seated woman that nestled inside, she looked pointedly at her sister's amber brooch. "Light, Avienda, we have Angreal, and neither of us is exactly helpless." Oh, Light, now she was sounding petulant. She knew very well that both of them together, Angreal and all, would be flies battling a flame against what they could sense. But even so, a fly bite at the right moment might make the difference. "And don't tell me I'll endanger the baby. Min said she will be born strong and healthy. You told me so yourself. That means I will live at least long enough for my daughter to be born." She hoped for a daughter. Fireheart chose that moment to nip at the gray, and Siswai nipped back, and for a bit Elaine was occupied with getting her gelding under control and keeping Avienda from being thrown and telling Casela that they did not need any help. And by the end of it, she was not feeling sullen any longer. She wanted to smack Fireheart right between his ears. Aside from making the animal obey the reins, Avienda behaved as if nothing had happened at all. She did frown, a little uncertainly, her face framed by the dark wool of her shawl, but her uncertainty had nothing to do with the horse. "I have told you about the rings in Ruidian," she said slowly, and Elaine gave an impatient nod.
Every woman who wanted to become a wise one was sent through a Tarangreal before she began training. It was something like the Tarangreal used to test novices for being raised to accepted in the White Tower, except that in this one, a woman saw her whole life. All of her possible lives, really, every decision made differently, an infinite fan of lives based on differing choices. No one can remember all of that, Elaine, only bits and pieces. I knew I would love Randall Thor. She was still uncomfortable sometimes about using just his first name in front of others. And that I would find sister wives. For most things, all you retain is a vague impression at best. A hint of warning, sometimes. I think if we go to him now, something very bad will happen. Maybe one of us will die. Maybe both, in spite of what Min said. That she said Min's name without fumbling was a measure of her concern. She did not know Min very well, and usually named her formally as Min Farshaw. Perhaps he will die. Perhaps something else. I do not know for sure. Maybe we will all survive, and we will sit around a fire with him, toasting Pekara when we find him, but the glimmer of a warning is there in my head. Elaine opened her mouth angrily. Then she closed it again, anger draining away like water down a hole, and her shoulders slumped. Perhaps Avienda's glimmer was true, and perhaps not, but the fact was that her arguments had been good from the start. A great risk taken in ignorance, and taking it might bring disaster. The beacon had grown brighter still, and he was there, right where the beacon was. The bond did not tell her so, not at this distance, but she knew. And she knew she had to leave him to take care of himself, while she took care of Andor. "I don't have anything to teach you about being a wise one, Avienda," she said quietly. "You are already much wiser than I, not to mention braver and more cool-headed. We return to Camelin." Avienda colored faintly under the praise. She could be very sensitive at times. But she wasted no time in opening the gateway, a rotating view of a stable-yard in the royal palace that widened into a hole in the air and let snow from the meadow fall onto the clean-swept paving stones as near 300 miles away as made no difference. The sense of Birgitta, somewhere in the palace, sprang alive in Elaine's head. Birgitta had a headache and a sour stomach, not unusual occurrences of late, but they suited Elaine's mood all too well. "I must leave him to take care of himself," she thought as she rode through. Light, how often had she thought that? No matter. Rand was the love of her heart and the joy of her life, but Andor was her duty.